Welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 4.7, where Michigan plays the same hockey game twice and then backs it up with a heart-stopping football victory. Did the thing where we record a podcast before we start recording the podcast again. So if there are enough comments requesting this, we should just record whatever we say in the very beginning and maybe we can throw it on as an addendum. But the people have to ask for it.
It's like the upcoming Beatles documentary on Disney Plus. It's just hours of secret footage that no one has ever seen. And maybe one day it'll be re-edited into a documentary.
Yes. So if you would like to hear it, please leave us some comments and we will consider throwing our, I guess, conversation in as an addendum potentially, or a secret third segment at the end of a hockey cast. I'm sure there are some people, but this puts the onus on the listeners. I was going to say viewers, but that's probably not true. So the listeners have to request it. And if we get enough requests, then we will consider it. You, on the other hand, though, have desired to talk about probably the worst NFL game ever played yesterday in some of the even worse weather to ever exist for a football game.
Okay, I watched the 2013 Snow Bowl game between the Lions and the Eagles. So that was definitely not the worst.
But that's like, okay, that's expected because it is a Snow Bowl. Like, you don't get quality anything in a Snow Bowl. You have to drop what your expectations are. This was not a great weather game, but it also wasn't like we're hopping over feet of snow for every yard.
It was definitely an all-timer Lions game because...
Which you sent me a list afterwards,
yeah,
by
the list
way.
Of the all-timer
games. Who
keeps
a list of these things?
There's about two per year, and we already got one of them earlier season on the Justin Tucker
the
game.
The Justin Tucker.
Number 60. Two.
Yeah.
But this one, also classic, because they have basically decided that Jared Goff can no longer throw the ball. And are basically just calling high school plays where I think they had multiple passing plays that lost yardage in this where he would throw behind the line of scrimmage and the guy would get tackled right away. And his stat line for the game is also one for the ages, 14 for 25 for 114 yards on 4.6 yards an attempt. And it was even grimmer than that before they had to start throwing the ball in overtime.
It sounds like a lot of people's opinion of early season Cade. Rip.
It's what you think. It's what you thought early season Cade was. You know, it's what it actually is.
And you clowns were all wrong.
And so then, I mean, the overtime. I mean, well, so number one, they're both playing for the loser point in regulation. Like, neither team trying to win the game late, and they're like, we'll just go to overtime. And, you know, the Lions drive into Steeler territory, and then Goff takes another just terrible sack. His sacks always lose, like, 10-plus yards because he just starts running backwards and then right into the guy that's chasing him.
Sort of like to Aaliyah.
Yeah, and then... They, you know, throw a deep bomb and then the cornerback comes and punches it out. So the Lions get the ball back. They drive into Steeler territory, set up for a field goal by Ryan Santoso, who's only the kicker because the other kicker is hurt, and just shanks it. An Alex Henry kick or a Nate Freeze kick for the Lions.
He didn't shank it. What was the quote of the
it's a terrible kick, and so they're trying to figure out what happened, right? And they're always trying to give the kicker the benefit of the doubt. And so they're looking at it, and Chris Darrell Johnson is like, you know, it looks like it's blocked, but it made it through clean. He just kicked it bad.
I don't think I've ever heard that before. How do you kick something bad? I mean, I guess you just plant wrong.
And so then the Steelers get the ball on their own 38, and you're like, well, okay, they're going to drive into Lions territory and win the game. And this is where it deviates from a same old Lions game, because then they hike the football 20 yards over the quarterback's head, and he has to run back and get it, which kills the drive instantly. And then they have, you know, Lions have another drive where they're basically playing for the tie and punt it away. So the Steelers get the ball, and the Lions decide, actually, no, we're not playing for the tie. We're going to start taking our timeouts to try and get it back with a minute left, because we all know Jared Goff can go 50 yards in a minute. and so they start taking timeouts that give the Steelers time to move into Lions territory, which everyone is like, we know how this one's ending. But again, it's not how we thought it was going to end, because again, the Steelers get a rusher into field goal-ish territory, and again, he fumbles, and the Lions recover with 15 seconds left, and then mercifully the game ends in a tie.
So is the curse broken? Like, they can still go 500.
They can still go 500. It's the perfect game, by the way, because it does not endanger the tank. It doesn't give them a win, but it also guarantees they don't go 0-17.
Man, Dan Campbell wanted to win, though.
Yeah.
You could just see it. He wanted this game, and I don't blame him by any means. He just, you could tell he was trying to do everything he could. I mean, that was part of, like, not throwing with Goff, right? Is it's like, hey, we're either tied or have the lead. We're moving the ball decently well on the ground from time to time.
Which,
like,
by the way,
let's not screw this up.
That is just embarrassing from the Steelers' standpoint. You're playing the Lions, who cannot throw the ball to save their lives and not even trying. And you give up, you and your, you know, defense that in the history of the Steelers franchise is a thing they pride themselves on, gives up 5.9 yards per carry to a team that is making no attempt to throw it.
I mean, that's some PSU versus Illinois stuff right there, isn't it?
And of course, the capper to this is the other Pennsylvania team smoked the Lions 2 weeks ago. So...
the Eagles.
Yeah.
Who maybe are okay. They won in Denver pretty big.
I think if you go 10-6-1, even if you're playoff eligible, you shouldn't be allowed to make the playoffs if the one tie was to the 2021 Detroit Lions.
I don't know if the Steelers only going to lose six games, though. Other things that must be discussed. One of them is the pronunciation of Michigan's goalie, which did... On the Thursday game, I believe it was Dave Starman who kept calling him Eric Portillo.
Yeah, he decided that Portillo
Is he from Sweden?
Yeah, which is phonetically very similar to English. But they decided that Portillo is actually from a Spanish-speaking country, and the double L becomes a Y sound.
Maybe he wears those big, like, sombrero hats.
Which I don't really... And by the way, that varies depending on what Spanish-speaking country you're from. In Argentina, the double L becomes a sh sound instead of a Y sound.
Really?
So if he assumed Portillo was Argentinian, it would have been Porticho.
That would have been... I'll tell you what, if he would have said that on the broadcast, I don't know what I would have done. I would have needed to call you and been like, hey, what does the double L sound like in Argentina?
Did you see
the pronunciation guide on the Friday game then?
No.
So they added his name to it. Like, he wasn't on the Eric Portillo. Now he's got me saying it. Eric Portillo was not on the pronunciation guide until the Friday game, when it was spelled out as... it was spelled as Portillo, and then the pronunciation was Portillo.
I got a like on Twitter one time from Eric Portillo's father, and I'd like to think that he called up Christie personally and was like, you better get this on the sheet now.
The other thing is, can we call him Sauce Portillo now?
That's a pretty good one.
So that's your pronunciation update for the week. The next thing that we need to discuss quickly is the field hockey update, which had probably one of the most bonkers endings to a field hockey game, that I've seen, which is not many, unfortunately. I have not seen a whole lot of field hockey games. I've seen more recently, considering Michigan's, dominance up until Sunday. But on Friday, they were playing in some terrible weather here and losing 2-1 to Miami, despite out shooting them like 5-1 or 6-1, which I think in field hockey is a lot because you don't get a ton of shots in field hockey generally. It's sort of like soccer in that sense, not like hockey where you can have 60 or 70 shots a game. And they score 2 goals in the final 61 seconds, including the game winner with 2.3, which was bonkers. I went back. I was still working day job at the time. And then I went back and I rewatched the ending of it. And it was I even got excited on the rewatch.
It was a very unfortunate weekend because that game I wasn't watching, but I saw the score on Twitter and I was like, well, that's going to suck. Like losing.
Oh, you mean the second one?
Well,
the Miami game. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, it's going to suck to be eliminated in the first round when you were the top four national seed. And
when you're hosting the final four.
And so then they come back and they win, and we're like, woo, bullet dodged.
Until Sunday when 2 feet of snow comes to Ann Arbor and you're expected to play outside in a field hockey game where I'm guessing they probably didn't have to like spray it down.
And by the way, ending a tournament game on a shootout is a disgrace.
So this game goes to a shoot. So the quarterfinal Harvard goes.
Game. Yes.
Yeah. The Harvard game is a quarterfinal game, goes to a shootout at 0-0 because nobody can score because I'm assuming the conditions were not great. And then they have to go to a shootout. And I didn't see it. I actually was.
It was not a great shootout for Speaker, the Michigan goalie. She tried the same thing 3 times and they scored all 3 times.
Oh, really? How many did Michigan score?
I don't think they scored any.
Wow, that's.
She did this thing where like she dropped down on her knees and like went to the right and then tried to like roll back to the left. And the Harvard women came in and just like faked that way and then wrapped it around the exposed side. And it happened all 3 times.
So. What do you do?
Although, actually, I don't know exactly because they didn't have a scoreboard for the shootout and they didn't have announcers for the shootout.
Yeah.
So the first one, I couldn't tell if the ball went in the net or not. And
well, it would be the cage, I think.
Yeah. Well, and then the third time the Harvard person scores, and I'm like, well, I think that should end it. And then I wait and then the team starts celebrating. Oh, OK. Yeah, that did end it. But BTN Plus at its finest.
Yeah, I think we've moved to BTN Minus. They've.
Why couldn't we get NCHC TV to call that?
Because that was so much better. So field hockey has a great year, wins a bunch of big games, and then gets screwed over by weather at home, ironically. Yeah. And went on the year that they're going to host everything. They're going to host the Final Four next weekend. And probably now no one is going to go. But that's how it goes. So the last thing I want to bring up before we get into this, and this is a good transition, and it's a great transition out of BTN Minus's field hockey coverage, is, all right, I know there are issues, but I like the Penn State play-by-play radio guy. I know last year, like the Avalanche of Goals guy. So I'm in on him because we have BTN on Thursday and BTN Plus on Friday. And the quality of viewing is stark, to say the least. Where Friday or Thursday, you can like watch the game. Friday, I have no idea who is who. Yet this guy is going to, it's like he drank like a 12 pack of Mountain Dew before the game because he just doesn't stop talking, but he just reiterates what he's seeing, which is good because I can't tell who's on the ice. So when he's going to tell me who has the puck and they pass it to this person who has the puck and he's checked by this guy, I'm like, oh, this is perfect. Now I know which line's on the ice because the quality of the viewing was terrible that I had no idea. I was like, if I can see one guy, maybe I can guess who the other ones are. But I think I'm in on him. He's a little too much Gus Johnson for me at times, but he uses a good vocabulary. He used extricate, I believe, and excavating the puck from behind the net. And I was like, all right, you know, I don't know if the puck got under like a bunch of ice and they had to like go get a pickaxe, but somehow they did get it out from behind. They extricate. He used a lot of those, which okay. I was impressed with his vocabulary, and he was descriptive, especially when I couldn't really see a whole lot of what was going on anyway.
Well, you know, the Friday game, I saw parts of, so I can't really. I had it on the phone with no audio at a steakhouse. So
well, that was gonna not gonna go well for you.
So yeah, I can't really comment on this.
But did you like him last year? I remember we talked because he was like the avalanche of goals guy.
Yeah, well, so last year their problem was that it wasn't him. It was their levels. What a thing you have to do before you call a game is like figure out where you're at and make sure that if you have to scream avalanche of goals, that you won't max out your input level because that'll be really bad. And that's what happened. So that's more on like the technical side, unless he's in charge of the sound, which he might be. So, yeah.
Yeah, the quality of his analyst was not great because after the second game, the play-by-play guy asked him what he learned about PSU this weekend, and he says, well, I learned that Ohio State can skate and play with the team of the quality of Michigan. And I was like, they lost 5-1 and 6-2 and didn't really come close on a ton of other goals, and Michigan missed a few. So I'm going to say that's not very true. But the play-by-play guy I'll give props to. And now that you know the scores of the game, which hopefully you watch them anyway, we should get into the games because we've talked about everything except the game so far. The Thursday game started weird in that no one had a shot for the first 5 minutes and Michigan didn't get their first shot until 9 minutes into the game. Have you ever seen a game where no one has a shot in the first period?
Not in the whole first period, no.
Okay. But Michigan took the first half of the first period and could not find the net. I mean, you know, not as a goal, but just even getting a puck on net.
Well, it definitely felt like both teams came in and sort of said, you know, we're not going to let the other team boat race us. So yeah, we're going to kind of feel it out for a bit.
Well, they felt it out for a while. Michigan did get a power play kind of after that. So in the latter half of the first period, and actually this is where Portillo, I thought, made probably the play of the weekend for him. Beniers got stripped of the puck at his own blue line and Penn State came in on a 2-on-1, and the first shot was up from a stark angle that the BTN guys were saying that he wasn't even really trying to score, he was just trying to create a rebound, which he did. And the second shot comes more down the slot, and Portillo makes obviously the first easier save, and the second one he gets his big right pad out and makes it, and I was like, whoa, like that's one of the better saves I've seen him make, and not generally a Portillo save. That was more of like a man save that we're used to him making. Portillo, if he adds that sort of save to his repertoire, becomes an even different level goalie.
Yeah. He's been a rock for Michigan all season and has been really good at coming up with those kind of saves early in games when Michigan is still trying to kind of find their feet in a contest. Remember, he did that against Lake State the first weekend of the season, and again against Duluth in the game. And
Minnesota State.
Yeah.
Both games that weekend.
That's kind of been a theme this year.
Michigan finally gets on the board late in the period from one of their depth lines. Dylan Duke, I thought, had a nice weekend. I wrote a couple blurbs about him in the breakdowns, but he forced a defensive zone turnover behind the net and hit Morgan out in front, who buried it with a shot, not a deflection like last week, but Morgan shot a puck. It went into the net. He was all alone pretty much in the slot / edge of the circle area, but a nice play from one of the depth lines. Duke is coming along. He had a goal early on a gaffe by a goalie, but has started to make plays, especially on the forecheck, and creating some chances in and around the net.
Yeah. Duke, you know, it was kind of a sloppy pass, but he's able to get in there and makes a really nice pass, and Luke Morgan's in the right spot, and you take that quick goal, and it's always good to get that sort of depth scoring from, you know, outside your top two lines.
I mean, it's kind of like if their third and fourth line score, this team should, in theory, almost never lose. I mean, if you're going to get goal, I mean, if you have to rely on your top two lines, you're probably going to be okay most of the time. But if you're getting goals from these guys, like, yeah, unless they're giving up 4 and 5 a game, it's going to be tough for anyone to really be able to score with them.
Yeah.
So it's 1-0 after one, and Michigan comes out hard in the second period. They have a power play that continues over, and you have a new resident of the Brissandot, and his name is Matty Beniers, as Owen Power finds him from just left of center at up near the blue line, and Beniers just bombs one home looking, I thought it was Brisson, and it was not. It was Beniers, and he has been on a tear. He has more goals later in this game and the next, but he's really starting to explode, not just in the things that we know that he can do, but as a goal scorer.
Yeah, his shot was not really something that a lot of people talked a lot about with him in terms of a prospect profile. And when they began the season, they did not build the power play around his shot. He was playing around the net or in the bumper slot, depending on the configuration early on. But something must have happened since they've moved him around, and they split up the two units. And I think that's working right now in terms of more evenly distributing the talent between the two. And I don't want to say his shot is in the Brisson caliber in terms of just a pure skill, but it's really effective right now. And when you can roll two power play units where you've got him as the shooter on one unit and Brisson as the shooter on the other unit, really opens up the possibilities. I think perhaps a most optimal configuration, honestly, could be having them both on the same unit with one on one side and one on the other. Your concern would be whether they can move the puck between each other, because what they've liked is Johnson or Bortolo flanking the other side. But as I kind of talked about in the summer, the 1-3-1 works the best when you have elite shooters and guys on both sides who can shoot and pass. And I think Beniers is not a bad passer. He might not see the Johnson lanes, but he can move the puck, and Brisson's come a long way as a passer. So I think it could work, but you know, what's going on right now is working well too. So
they're the same handedness though, right? I mean, I think they're both left-handed. So would it be difficult to put the other guy, one of them on the left dot? Because they both try to go to the right dot.
Yeah, I mean, you can always switch that stuff around and try and figure it out.
Penn State gets another power play, and Portillo, I thought, was very good on this, on their, I believe it was, no, Penn State gets their first one. I'm sorry, I wrote that down wrong. And Portillo came up very huge, especially after a Kent Johnson turnover. So he's on the penalty kill next to Beniers. So that the Beniers part makes sense. I'm losing my patience a little bit with Johnson playing next to him on the kill, because this is another time where he's deep below the goal line and tries to get the puck out, gets almost nothing on it, and basically has a centering pass, and a guy walks right down the slot. And Portillo makes a big save, and that was sort of another contribution to what I called potentially Portillo's best game of the year. Is that was a huge moment in the game for him to make that denial.
Yeah, I don't love Johnson on the penalty kill either. You know, I think what Mel Pearson is trying to do is, when we talk about who are KJ's comparables at the NHL level, I mean, the one that comes up often is Mitch Marner, and Marner is a very, very good penalty killer.
Is he?
Something that's forgotten sort of about him. I mean, Matthews does not kill penalties, but Marner does and is very effective. But I don't think Johnson has that same skating ability or sort of tenacity, and he still is pretty slight. I mean, Marner's not a big boy either, but Marner, I think, reads the plays defensively a little bit better than Johnson does. I think Johnson reads plays offensively really well, but not at that same caliber in his own end. And he's not a guy who's going to be able to hit, right, really with any capacity. Yeah. And penalty killers, you tend to want guys who can throw a check and jar the puck free and then clear it down the ice. And that's not really what he does. His big thing is he creates offense and he opens up plays. And that's not what a penalty killer is supposed to be doing. So it's just kind of an odd fit for me. And maybe in the future he can get there, but not right now.
Yeah, and I think that they're obviously challenging him and wanting him to grow there. And they're used to playing him with Beniers and probably saying, hey, you know, when you go to the NHL, you know, you may be tasked to do this or asked. And that's a good way to, you know, get more ice time in that sense. But you know, they just, I mean, I just think Michigan has a bunch of really good penalty killers. I mean, the Van Wyen Moyle pairing, you have Luke Morgan, who's been really good at it. Beniers can play there. And then I think the other thing about that, the other reason that they probably want him out there is for shorthanded goals. Because if you can get a deflection and send him the other way, you know, he's a guy that you probably want on a breakaway as much as anybody.
Yeah, I don't like pressing for shorthanded goals unless you're down in a game late or something like that. Because this Michigan team, this is not Michigan State, right? Like, this is not a team that is unable to score goals at even strength. We've got to pull out all the stops to kind of manufacture offense. This team is going to lose games if they cannot kill penalties. Like, that's one of the only ways an opponent can get back in a game when you're facing a team that's tilting the ice at even strength. So why press on the penalty kill when that's like one of the only chances your opponent gets to get back in a game?
Right. Those are the situations especially you survive.
Especially if you're whipping them at even strength, right? So then it's just sort of, I don't really get the point of that unless you're down 3-2 with 4 minutes to go.
Penn State gets back in the game temporarily with sort of a goofy goal, I thought. Like, it wasn't really an odd man rush or a breakaway. A guy's coming in.
Well,
down.
It became one because of Jacob Triscott.
So he's in the zone, though.
He's in the zone. He doesn't make a particularly great effort to stop the guy from getting around him.
And he doesn't. But he was on the other side, I think. And he's coming across. You can see him coming across the slot.
Yeah,
the guy has the angle.
Yeah, the guy drags around him, basically.
Right. And Truscott.
And then the second guy, who wasn't really in the play, but does have a step on Michael Pastajov, comes in. And after Portillo makes the initial save, the puck's right there. The attacker goes into a hockey stop and the puck goes off his foot and in the net. And
it was reviewed and
it was not a distinct kicking motion. He's very clearly trying to stop and it just, you know,
or he's trying to kick it with a spraying motion, which is probably more likely because that's all you have to do. Cause Portillo is on the post, makes the save, but the puck gets bumped out. And that's one of the things that we've mentioned a little bit and people have criticized him with the rebound control. I don't really fault that.
There's nothing
that
you can do
him.
That on that
no,
one.
No, because I mean, you got to stop the first shot.
Maybe his defenseman shouldn't let the guy walk right by him.
Maybe.
Right?
Like, yeah, and so it's 2-1 off of I don't even know if you get a shot for that. I mean, I guess, but that's more of a, I don't know how you score those goals. I guess it's a shot. It's just a shot with a skate blade.
I mean, Perry Berezan scored a goal on the bench when the Oilers put it in their own net. He was the last one to touch it after he threw it down the ice. And I think that counted as a shot. So,
well, I mean, they probably counted this one. It's Penn State. He probably got three shots for it in actuality. And another one where Michigan again is up two, then they're up one and we're getting late in the third. And you're like, it's going to be another tough third period. And they just respond right away. As Brendan Brisson has loaned out his dot again to yet another Michigan shooter, and Power, who had a very nice assist game, finds Johnny Beecher posted up there with a great diagonal pass, and Johnny Beecher snipes one from the Brisson dot, and it's 3-1. And at that point, you're like, okay, we're back on track, going to the end of the period, and Michigan is in good shape again.
Yeah, I thought that this was not the best period for Michigan. I thought their energy level was a little low in the second and Penn State was really coming at them and then Penn State scores. But it was a good response. I'll give them that. And Beecher gets the goal there. And I thought that was his best game of the season. Not saying much. He's played like four games. But it was a really sharp game from Beecher and shows what he can give the team as a third line center.
Yes.
That is, you know, just better than their other options, right? Like there's his skill level, his talent level, the things he can do when he's clicking. No offense to Luke Morgan and Jimmy Lambert, but they can't give you that. They can't give you that size, the skill, the shooting ability. When it all pops for Beecher, you see why the Bruins believed in him.
Right. His upside is high, and his upside is something that no one else has on this team. I mean, no one else is 6'2 and is that big and can also skate and drive the net.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of putting together what you said, but we've seen that a few times. You know, it's great if he has that shot and it's great if he's winning faceoffs and all that, but when he can take the puck and go to the net, it's sort of like a big point guard that can bully you and get to the basket. Like that's exactly what Beecher is. And he's starting to show that a little bit more. We'll get into another really nice play he has in when we talk about the third. The one thing I did want to mention too, is I wrote down that Portillo had two big saves in probably the last 20 seconds of the second period. This was a great game from him. He just made a number of different kinds of saves and he was always there when called upon. That was the only goal he gave up, and that's in no way on him. I mean, sure, you'd love it if he can smother the puck or direct it to the corner, but, like, I mean, when your defenseman gets beat and a guy's coming in hard and you just make that initial save, that's really all you can ask for and hope your defenseman get around to clear it. And other than that, though, he was phenomenal and kind of saved it again, like I said, at the end of the second period before Michigan comes out and definitively wins the game in the third.
Yeah, and they came out really strong in the third, and once they get that, you know, that fourth goal, the game's kind of over at that point, because you've got Portillo playing so well and the confidence level is so high that it just doesn't really feel like Penn State can come back from that.
Yep, and that happened relatively early, and this was a great shift, I thought, from Penn State keeping the puck in the zone for a while. Michigan was struggling to clear, and it was sort of those Beniers forever shifts that we talk about, where Beniers and Johnson tend to have a shift or two a game where they're just in the zone for a long period to the point of where everyone on the ice can rotate off, you know, they can get a change. And Penn State sort of had that, and finally Beecher's able to get the puck and he gets out of the zone, which is always good to get an exit. Then he gets a zone entrance where he the other side is on a 3-on-2, makes a nice move, and Van Wy cuts behind him. He drops the puck between his legs, and Van Wy has a nice low, hard shot that gets through audio, and it's 4-1. The thing I've mentioned is that Moyle did not play in this game, and they moved Van Wy from the fourth line up playing with Beecher, and he was the recipient of that nice move by Beecher. Good for Van Wy when he scores, but also a very nice play driving assist from Johnny Beecher.
Yeah, I thought it was a good individual effort from Beecher on that play. I didn't love that goal allowed by Oscar Adio. He might have been screened by the Penn State defenseman in front of him, but it's never great when you sort of let Van Wy score on you from that far out. Like, you know, it wasn't a change. You know, it was a drop pass. It wasn't a change of sides pass. He wasn't sliding across. That's not Michigan's top 10 shooters on the team, maybe top 15 shooters on the team. So, yeah, didn't love that goal allowed, but Michigan will take it. And I think after this weekend, we'll talk about this when we wrap it up, but I think Penn State's goaltending is pretty clearly a weakness of the team, and Michigan took advantage of that in this game.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me a couple of times. Penn State had two power plays, one before what we just talked about, one right afterwards, and all my notes are on that is almost nothing. I had Portillo made maybe one save in each one, but Michigan pretty much diffused their power play for the most part, especially in this game and for the most part the next night too. I didn't think that they had a ton of good chances, especially with the time that they had. The other one... The other thing I want to talk about is I wrote this down as Hughes versus everybody, where he just goes from one end to the ice to the other and narrowly misses a backhanded goal, but he just goes coast to coast. This is like ceiling Quinn Hughes, right? Where he takes the puck and just outskates everybody, dekes three guys, goes through the entire team, and had a chance to finish it off with a goal. If he did, I mean, they probably should just call the game at that point, because it's like, I mean, we've just seen the best thing you can possibly see tonight. He misses it. They get a power play, which they end up scoring on. But Quinn Hughes had his gaffes, but his ceiling was on display this past weekend.
You know, I think that it might be recency bias. I might have to go back and watch some of the old tape, but it feels like Luke Hughes makes more jump out of your seat level plays than Quinn did. Quinn, I think, saw the ice better in the offensive zone and made more sort of mind-bending passes. But when Luke has the puck on his stick, it's more electric, I think, than Quinn was. They both can do the little shimmy thing where the defenseman, you know, the defender falls and they go around him. And, you know, Quinn obviously is an immaculate skater in all directions and great on his edges and all that stuff. But when Luke sometimes does that, like once a game, it's just like a bolt of lightning thing that we didn't see as much. I mean, we saw more of it when Quinn was a sophomore, but also a lot of times it was just sort of like, well, our, you know, our best center is a guy that with like 6 points. So you have to do all the offense now. Whereas when Luke does it, he's really seizing an opportunity, right? He's not forcing it because his team is offensively handicapped. And I think that's what makes it so fun, is that it's just out of nowhere. Suddenly, boom, there he goes. And all the scouts lauded his edge work and his agility and everything, but his top end speed is lethal too. And he's so confident with the puck on his stick, and he handles it like a forward. I am fully all in on the Luke Hughes hype train. So whoever the NJD prospects guy is needs to follow me, because they will like my tweets now.
Yeah, the Columbus Blue Jackets guy like tweets at both of us and talks
Kent
to us
Johnson
about,
all the time.
He doesn't, anytime we mention KJ, he's like, boom, this guy.
He doesn't know anything about college football, and so he's very confused a lot. And asked me why we laugh at Nebraska, so I had to explain that.
The other thing I wanted to say about Hughes is the most interesting thing about it is, like, you look at Michigan and you're like, oh, they're stacked on their first two, maybe two and a half lines, of which just, I mean, no one that can really match up to these lines. And then you look at Owen Power, and then when Blankenberg is healthy, him or that first pairing, and then you bring Luke Hughes off the second pairing, and you're like, how am I, what am I supposed to do, like, defensively, just to even come up with a game plan for this other than you know, pretty much turtle everything and hope to get a power play. But so they get the power play on this, and you, once again, you have power to Beniers this side, this time on the Oppo dot, I called it, from the Brisson dot.
Yeah.
And it's another snipe from Beniers. It's 5-1. And this is just,
this point, the game's over.
Not really
anything else to talk about. Right.
But this is what this team can do and what they should do on not a nightly basis, but 2 to 3 out of every 4 times is the competition they're going to face, and the capabilities that they have are just like, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, you can come up with whatever you want, and this is going to happen to you if they execute at this level.
Pretty much. And, you know, this was kind of the routine win, right? You're playing a team that I don't think is particularly great, and you're supposed to be a great team, and you take care of business, right? The Corsi wasn't as lopsided, but you always have some Penn State cooking going on when you're in state college, so tough to kind of tell about that. But at the end of the day, your talent wins the day. You've got a better goalie than them. You've got better finishers than them. You get about equal shots, but a lot more of yours go in because of that reason, and it's not really close by the last 10 minutes. So,
and you remember Michigan from a few years ago, where they were getting all those good chances and nobody could finish. Well,
yeah, well, it
you,
really
you
makes
give them those chances now, and
it makes
they're
a difference.
Get goals.
It makes a difference when you sub out Jacob Hayhurst for Brendan Brisson.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Segment, we're going to have the same segment.
You won't enjoy this one.
You won't.
It'll just be a repeat, but yeah.
But don't go back and re-listen to the first one. Listen to this one, because it's going to be the same but slightly different, including Michigan having a odd first period again. Now, this was – so there were some personnel things. Like, we thought Blankenberger was going to play in this series. He did not. Holtz, again, played with power in both games. But in the second game, Moyle comes back to play with Van Wy. They jumble the lines a little bit. I think Brisson ends up with KJ and Veneers. And then you have Keaton Pearson. Yes, I got it. I've been practicing trying to say his name over and over and over again. I have conversations with other people just trying to bring him up so I can practice saying his name. Keaton Pearson.
It's your new vocal warm-ups.
That's right.
To have that in speech and debate, right? To get your, like, whatever tongue twisters are to get your mouth going. It's just Keaton Pearson over and over
again. Keaton Pearson. Yeah. Just say Mel. It's just like Mel. It's just like Mel. It's just like Mel. Keaton Pearson. He plays for the first, 5 minutes of the game and then gets, like, the most unfortunate call. And I put in my game – in my game breakdown, like, you know, okay, give me comments and argue with me all you want. I just, he is on the third pairing, hadn't played in a few games, I think 3 games, and comes back, plays for Edwards, and, like, is near center ice, and he's going for a check because he has the angle on the guy, and the guy, like, goes down. I don't know if he loses a little bit of his edge, but he comes down, and Pearson hits him in the head. Pearson hits him in the head. And goes into the boards. And yeah, it's a rough looking hit and everything. But, like, what are you supposed to do when a guy just goes down and all of a sudden, like, your shoulder and arm are going to hit him in the head instead of in the body because he's now, like, your height?
Well, you seem to be learning that in a sport where everyone moves super fast, that you can't totally control your body.
So...
That's the curse of checking out. You know, targeting in football too, right? You intend to do one thing and then the game moves so quickly sometimes it doesn't happen, and a lot of times it's bad luck, right?
So half of
the targetings in football and these kinds of plays, half of them are really bad situations, like what we have seen this season, the hit on Jack Summers in the Duluth game, that sort of thing, that's really bad, Fontaine-perfect type stuff. And then the other half is stuff that they didn't really intend to do, and that's probably what this falls into.
My problem with targeting in college football is the name. Like, targeting implies you're targeting someone. This and a hit like this is not targeting. It's obviously it's college hockey, not college football, but it's not, he's not intending to do that because the captain for Penn State comes over and he gets all big, like puffer fish, like, and Pearson, good Lord. Keaton Pearson is like, dude, he puts his arms up like, hey, I didn't mean to, like, I'm sorry. Like, I didn't mean to do that. This dude decided to all of a sudden be as tall as my hips. And, like, I obliterated him, and I don't know. So he gets tossed and he gets a 5 minute major. And you pair that with another power play that Penn State got, and Michigan, like, didn't have the puck, like, for the entire first period because they're killing, like, 7 minutes of PSU power play time.
Yet they did get a goal in that first period.
that's the funny thing is, so they kill the major, and right at the end of the major, Luke Hughes, drinks his diesel jet fuel again and goes shooting out of a cannon and has a breakaway and actually beats Soulier.
Yeah.
I was really bummed when he started because I was like, well, I know Audio's name. Yeah. And I can say Audio. And now this guy is Soulier. He beats him, but the shot just goes wide. And you're like, you know, wow, after all of that and all that power play time, which I didn't have a whole lot down for Penn State on this either. Like, they had a couple positional saves from Portillo, and he had a nice one early. And then they had a good chance it went wide, but I mean, for 5 minutes, I didn't think that they did a great job. And then Michigan probably has the best chance out of both teams.
So I did not see any of the game up to this point because I was on the subway and they're, you know,
not the restaurant.
Not the restaurant.
Okay.
No, they have cell service in a subway, not the subway. So we finally sit down at the table and I pull out the BTN Plus app and put it on the phone, and Penn State is beginning the power play, but they don't have a score box working.
Sure.
So I don't really know what's
BTN going. Minus.
Yeah, I don't really know what's going on. And I'm like, well, Penn State looks like they're on the power play, but they're not really getting any shots. And then it just keeps going. And I'm like, are they still shorthanded? Like, damn, this is a long power play. And like, this feels like this has been several minutes. And then, you know, finally I go to Twitter later and I'm like, oh, it was a major. That makes sense. But no, there was nothing that made me ignore my grapefruit margarita. So that's what you need to know.
Grapefruit.
Grapefruit. Yeah.
Was that good?
It was different, but it was solid.
Sounds kind of poignant.
No. we'll just leave it at that.
Okay, that sounds good. So you're right. They do get a goal, and it was like, I mean, this was probably one of the worst goals. I mean, not goals. I mean, because Brisson had a nice little move, but like the puck comes in, and he just sort of like people complain about rebound control from Portillo, but like Soleri, no. Ugh.
Soulière, yeah.
Soulière, this is a nightmare. Soulière, like, just bumps literally the rebound right to Brisson in front of him, and he waits and goes high backhand, which is a nice little move to have, but, like, it was one of those warm-ups, you know, when they're shooting at no goalie, and all of a sudden they get a puck right there, and the things you practice, you just kind of go, oh, forehand, backhand, and then you try to roof it. I mean, that's what it was, and there was, like, no one there because the goalie just like gave it to him. So it's 1-0, which is the last thing if you're Penn State you need to do to this team is like give away goals, because they're probably going to take a few. And this one was, especially after that, where you have like all this momentum and it's just this goofusness.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple more notes that I had were just all for Portillo. He broke up, he had a cross crease deflection where like the puck tried to come through, stuck a stick out, knocked it away. That was really nice. Beniers had another horrible defensive zone turnover, and Portillo made another save, this one from the slot. And then he had a couple of nice saves even towards the end of the period. Good positioning. Penn State had a chance, but Portillo, again, just really fitting this team well, because he is going to get hung out to dry from time to time, but he's really getting to make those acrobatic saves at, like we said in the first segment, adding him to his great positional saves, because shooting at him is basically like shooting at a mountain. You have this huge guy. And I think that that's becoming part of their defensive structure is like, all right, we'll give you shots from the boards, especially at angles, because you're literally going to have nothing to shoot at. Cause this guy can just sit on the post and take up all of the space, and you can't even see like a sliver of the net. And Penn State was like, oh, I'll take that shot, like repeatedly in this series. And it was like, oh, a chance. Not really. I mean, it's unless he like disappears or like cannot stop matter or something, the puck is never going in from those angles. And it's just exactly what he needed to do. 1-0 at the end of the first period.
Yeah. And you are always happy to lead by one at the end of a period.
That's true. If you win every period 1-0, you're going to be in good shape.
You're going to win a lot of games that way.
You're going to win a lot of games. Second period starts out well for Penn State. Again, this time they do score, and this was something that was not on Portillo either. There was a shot from the point that hits a mass of bodies. It was actually Kenny Johnson. Do you remember Kenny Johnson? Jack's little brother is somehow still in college. Jack is in his, 17th year. He's playing with the Avs on their third pair, and his brother's in college.
Yeah, it's kind of wild, but
he's a big guy.
Yeah.
And he had a shot from the point that was redirected over to the other side of the crease, where McManaman just hit an open net, and Portillo kind of gets out of position, but like, you know, he's anticipating a shot from the right. It redirects and dies over on the left. McManaman has an open net. Again, nothing you can really do with that. It's 1-1, and you're like, oh, you know, here we go. Penn State's going to mount their charge until like the next shift or two shifts later. And this is, again, we're going to bring up Dylan Duke. And he had a really nice entrance into the zone. And then it ends up being a 3-on-2. It starts as a 3-on-2. He enters the zone as 3-on-2. And Luke Hughes just comes as a bolt of lightning, as you like to say, for him out of nowhere, shoots down just to the left of the slot. And it's a tough pass because Duke has a guy in front of him, and Hughes just goes shooting right by, but he sort of chips it over his defender's stick, like a sauce pass, I guess. Is that what you hockeyers call it?
Sure.
To Luke Hughes, who creates an odd man rush out of nothing, and then he picks a corner after that. And so that is like the full offensive Luke Hughes experience. 2-1.
This is the portion of the game. I mean, these next 10 or 15 minutes to the end of the second period where Michigan really grabs the game by the horns, because Penn State gets very few chances in this stretch, and Michigan scores 3 goals and could have scored 3 more.
Yeah, the next note I have is Bortolo going coast to coast, but his shot goes wide and with some phenomenal stick handling, and you're like, man, this is just like – it's like layup drills, right, where you have one guy just going to, all right, I'll take all these guys, and the next guy gets the ball, all right, I'll take all these guys. And it could have been 3-1 there, but they would have to wait a little bit longer, especially until BTN minus goes out. So we're just sitting there, and it was gone. And I'm like, I wonder if I'm even going to be able to write anything after this game, because I'm not going to be able to see anything. And so we're like scrambling around. We get Al Randall on the radio because WCBN doesn't have Alex Drain anymore. And
we never traveled to Penn State. Well, we might have done that because of the football trip, you know, if I had still been there. But we never went to Penn State for hockey. Just wasn't worth it normally. But yeah, so the thing about that is at that point, it's like no stream available. And so now I'm running through all these things. I'm like, oh, is like the cell service in this restaurant bad? And then I'm like, well, no, the tweets are loading just fine. And just kind of like, I don't know, maybe this is something with my phone or whatever. And then eventually I'll go back on, but I go back on, and I'm kind of like behind. So I see, I didn't go to live. I'm like 7 minutes behind. So I'm watching the Beniers goal and I'm like, wait a second. Didn't I already see that? Like, I don't know what's going on with this. And then I go to live and I'm like, oh, it's 4-1 now or something. And
yeah.
Just what a mess.
People on Twitter are like, so the thing about BTN minus is you just have to kind of like refreshing it. It's not going to come back. So you have to go out and go back in again, go out and go back in again. Michigan gets their first power play when we were on the blackout phase. And it was a Kent Johnson shot that Beniers redirected. And apparently it was great vision from KJ, according to Al Randall. So I've yet to see this goal. I guess I could have gone back and watched it. But
yes,
other things happened this weekend.
Right.
And that is what I have from that, which made it 3-1. And then my next note is I got excited and I wrote "It's back" in all caps as I was able to watch the game again.
Yeah, 3-1, you're feeling pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple more chances for Michigan, they get that fourth goal from Bortolo. And then that's the point at which the game feels over.
So the interesting thing is I wrote down a 2-on-1 where Pasta skated in and got all the way to the crease and didn't really shoot.
That's one of my least favorite things. I think you have been around me watching hockey enough, and the friend I had this weekend over could testify to this, but I like to yell, shoot the puck.
Right, you do.
Right. Like that's because you see that with guys where they, you got to know when to pass, but you also have to know when to shoot. And a lot of times an odd man rush is the big mistake they make is looking for the extra pass that isn't there. And so that can be just kind of frustrating.
And then that was followed up by Wall getting a breakaway 1v0 on Portillo, and he didn't really shoot either. So there, and you get it. I wrote down Portillo sprawl and cover because he kind of like ended up freezing the puck. But again, there was no, that's a little more confusing as to how you can come in on a breakaway and not really shoot. But Wall for Penn State managed to do that. And then the Morgan Duke pairing hooked up again, which was a really nice little play. This time it was Morgan creating a defensive zone turnover off a really nice forecheck. I thought he had a nice underrated weekend and dished to an open Duke on the other side. And Duke actually put the shot right where you want. And Solaire got his big glove up and snared it out of nowhere. And that was a game saver at the time because it was 3-1. It would have made it 4-1. But again, a nice little play from Duke and Morgan. You know, Morgan has fit in on a number of lines this year. I think he has a skill set that can be an asset to a couple of different groups of forwards.
Yeah, I think that tandem
is doing that too.
Yeah, well, I think that tandem works pretty well with Morgan and Duke, because Duke skating is the big weak spot on his scouting report, and Morgan, you know, that's his strength, and they can both forecheck a little bit, but Morgan can go deep in the zone using the speed, be the first one in the zone, can retrieve the puck, can throw it to the front, and Duke can, you know, likes to play around that area. So I think that's an effective tandem for two guys who can kind of feed off each other's, particularly on the forecheck.
And then finally, Thomas Bortolo gets a goal.
Yeah.
It had been a while since game four, I believe, against Minnesota State. He walked into the high slot with a nice little skating move and took a slap shot, which was kind of interesting, and picked a corner with a slap shot, making it 4-1. Just another guy on this team that can shoot.
Yeah. And I mean, the third period kind of went the way you'd expect for a game like this, where you go up and you're like, the game's kind of over. And then it is, you know, I mean, Penn State gets a goal back and then nothing really happens. Michigan adds a couple on, and that's kind of the end of it. But
yep. Power had an easy.
Yeah, the difference between a two-goal lead and a three-goal lead going into that third was really big, because Penn State, not the offensive powerhouse they once were, they do play a style that could maybe dig back from that. They weren't going to be able to dig back from three down.
No, especially with their lack of finishers and their goals in this game, in this entire series were, I mean, they're kind of garbagey, and that's not what we're used to seeing from Penn State, is they tend to overwhelm you and get some open nets with their passing and creative shooting and stuff like that. But that's not, I mean, they had to go deep in the crease and get their dirty goals to this weekend. And it's just, you're just not going to get a lot of those, right? You know, I mean, that's just when, especially when you're down a bunch of goals. And then, you know, right in the beginning of the third, Owen Power gets a loose change dunk after a nice play. I think Johnson, Beniers and Power crashed the net, and there's just a puck laying out there. The goalie's down. He just has an easy goal. It's 5-1 at this point. And that was about the time when I was like, well, not sure how many more notes that we can really take. I did write down that you said you had a nice steak.
It was pretty solid. That's what I'll say.
How did you have it cooked?
Medium is always my preferred.
Is that what you do? Okay. Yeah. And I thought the game was more or less over, but then Truscott went to the box and Moyle went to the box. So Michigan was in a 5-on-3 situation, or 3-on-5, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. And they almost kill it. That was the thing, is like they do a really good job. Truscott's penalty is killed. Moyle's is about to be killed. They get the puck to the blue line. It's almost out, just held in. But you can see that it was a very nice hold by the Penn State player, because the other three guys on the ice for Michigan all like break forward like they're going to leave the zone, and a couple of them are going to join the rush. But it's held in, so now everyone's out of position, and the puck gets low. Portillo makes a great initial save again, but the rebound is easily finished because everyone's out of position and the puck wasn't cleared. And, you know, it's tough for goalies to make back-to-back great saves. Like when you see that, especially on the power play, like it's something to really enjoy, because you expect to get the first one, but if you get two, I mean, that's something to frame usually.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. You give up a goal late in the game, you're winning by a ton, you don't really care.
And then Luke Hughes gets the soft goal, as I wrote down, as this is probably going to lend into our takeaways from the weekend, but he walks down the slot and shoots one that I think went through Solaire.
Yeah, there's kind of two reactions I have to bad goals. One of them is if it's a really egregious, like a Tristan Jarry thing from the playoffs back in the spring when he melted down for Pittsburgh, where you just sort of go, oh no, like that's one reaction. The other reaction is with like facial expressions too, like a very visual podcast thing, right? Where you watch the replay and you've got a furrowed brow and you're gritting your teeth and you're like, yeah, I don't know about that one. And that was that, you know, not a howler, but definitely one that you kind of would expect him to make.
Well, a guy walking down the slot and the puck goes through like your outline of your person, you generally want someone to save those, I think. I mean, if a guy picks a corner, it's different, but like, or you have to dive to like make a blocker save. But this one, I think, went under his arm, and you're like, you know, at this level, those are saves you should make.
Yeah.
6-2 final. Kind of like the first game in a lot of ways. The score differential is the same. Michigan starts a little bit slow, ramps up momentum, and then just puts away an inferior opponent that doesn't really have a backup or a goalie because they played Audio and he was a little iffy, and then they played Soler and not great either.
Yeah.
So a nice sweep. I think we like it was a series that you looked at and you're like, this is what should happen. We kind of expected it to happen. You never really know. And that's sort of what we thought last year. And Michigan sort of houses them in the first game. And then the second game is they get blown out. And so you just, you really never know in those situations, but you look at this team and you say, this is what you need to do to a Penn State. You know, they did it last week to Michigan State. They did it to Penn State this week. I'm not going to say quite that to Notre Dame. I think Notre Dame's better coming up. We're going to talk about them in a minute, but when you play these bottom two or three teams in the Big Ten, it needs to be two wins, and Michigan has done that the last 2 weeks.
You know, I'm kind of creeping in the haunted house right now on my tiptoes, trying not to make any noise in case karma jumps out with a chainsaw. But I don't think it's too early to say this team is pretty good, folks.
Yeah, they
are.
That
was kind of my takeaway from the weekend. I mean, you look at the numbers. You are 10-2, and you have a +26 goal differential, which is over 2 goals per game. You're outscoring the opponent by. You've got six players that are at a point per game or higher. You have a goalie with a .927 save percentage. That sounds like a really good team to me.
I mean, what's the worst part about this team?
Losing to Wisconsin.
Okay, well, losing games.
Yeah,
I don't like it when they lose. Yeah, I get that, but to me the answer there isn't one. I mean,
I would say that the weakest part is sometimes getting sloppy in the defensive end.
Sure.
I mean, it's kind of up to this juncture. I would say that it resembles in some ways, and this is a comparison that some people may be happy about. Ohio State football over the last 7 years, where like whenever they lose in the conference, it's because their coach fell asleep at the wheel or their quarterback melted down or like they didn't give it to their generational running back in a big game for some reason. Right. It's like whenever you beat Ohio State, half of it is Ohio State beating themselves. And yep. That's, I mean, Michigan's losses this year are equally kind of on them, where they just didn't lock in mentally. So,
well, the Wisconsin game for sure.
Yeah.
The Western game, I think they got
you can
pushed
cut
around.
Western a bit more slack, but that's kind of what it is. When this team is really all in and everything's clicking, there isn't a lot you can do.
Around the Big Ten, we can start in Minneapolis, which that series went slightly different than we expected. Minnesota did win the second game 2-0, but the first game they're up 3-0. Is that correct? And
yeah.
They end up losing 4-3 to Ohio State.
So we have to talk.
Ohio State scores goals.
We have to talk about Jack LaFontaine might be bad now. He's sitting at .898 save percentage through 12 games, which is not a big enough sample to really conclude anything yet, but that's not great. And that's in the ballpark of what he was his last year at Michigan. He was in 11 games at .889. So still better than that, but his first 2 years in Minneapolis, .919 save percentage in 2020 and .934 last year. Again, those were in 25 and 29 games. So he has some time to turn it around. But save percentage is often more indicative of the goalie, whereas goal against average is normally more indicative of the team because, right, Chris Osgood could get a pretty good goals against average because he's facing 17 shots a game on, you know, really good Red Wings teams. Save percentage, you can have a goals against over three and like a .940 save percentage. Like if your team is just awful, you still give up three goals, but you save 40 others, then your goals against looks bad, but your save percentage would be really darn good. So save percentage is often the metric in the absence of advanced models to assess goaltending. And when you see a 36-point drop in save percentage, something might be going on there. And like that game against OSU, I didn't see it, so I can't tell you what happened, but Ohio State can't really score. They're leaning entirely on their very good goaltender. Minnesota outcourses Ohio State like 2-1. They get 3 goals behind Ohio State's goaltender, who's their whole team, and they lose the game. That either is your goaltender or it's maybe all four goals Ohio State scored were breakaways. I don't know. Didn't see the game, but generally speaking, that should not happen. If you're scoring three on Dobish and tilting the ice at even strength against a team like Ohio State, it should be an easy win.
The other thing about Minnesota is that if you're going to say what's the strength of this team, it's probably going to be their defensemen.
Right, because they lost pieces on offense in Sampo Ranta, among others. They lost three of their top six scorers, but they got almost everybody back on the back end.
And their defense was really good. Like, their defensemen were, like, all drafted. Like, they have six drafted defensemen or some absurd number.
And the amount of goals.
So it's probably not the defense.
Yeah, you would think. But, again, we haven't watched it. And we'll talk to, hopefully, someone who knows a little bit more about Minnesota before Michigan plays them. But
yes,
just eyeballing the box score, I tend to think that JLF is the culprit here, and it pains me to say that because we all like him, but that's what's different about this team than last year. They're giving up a lot more goals, and the goalie save percentage is a lot worse than it used to be. So not sure what's going on there, but Minnesota right now does not really look like a contender on Michigan's level. They look kind of like one notch below that in the same tier as Notre Dame and maybe Ohio State.
Michigan State played Ferris in a home-and-home and won 2-0 in East Lansing and 4-3 in Big Rapids. I don't have a ton to say about this. We know about Michigan State. Ferris is nondescript,
Whatever.
So they win two games, but they're not in the Big Ten.
We've already seen Michigan State. We know what they are.
The head-turning here results here are not only does Notre Dame beat Wisconsin twice, but they beat them 4-1 and 3-0, giving up only one goal.
That
could be Michigan level of stuff because, you know, Michigan did shut them out, I think 3-0, and then they definitely gave away a few goals the next night. But
that series, looking at those box scores, is really why I'm kind of angry about losing that Wisconsin game, just because that team cannot score at all, and Michigan let them score way too much than is acceptable in that second game. So that's kind of to lose two losses at this juncture, I'm fine with. 10-2,
right?
Perfect for me in terms of preseason expectations. It just kind of hurts that the team they lost to is really bad, and I think we can say that now about Wisconsin.
Well, I asked you in our prep, in our secret segment number three that we didn't record, about would you trade that Wisconsin loss for a loss to Lake State?
I think
the answer is probably yes.
For one, it's not in conference, and I would be willing to bet very highly that Lake State is better than Wisconsin. There was a piece published in Bucky's Fifth Quarter, a fan blog of Wisconsin, last night, saying it's time to fire Tony Granato. So you can tell where the fan base is right now.
Well, and I mean, they had a nice year last year, but before last year, they had some talent, and their previous couple years were they could score some goals, but man, did they give up goals too.
I think that Tony Granato deserves a little more slack because he just won the Big Ten like 6 months ago. It's kind of
COVID year.
Kind of weird to fire the coach right after that. However, I think the very concerning thing is that team was built off of talent. And when you look at their recruiting, they're not recruiting that talent anymore. And the big reason is he came in at a time when Michigan and Minnesota were in upheaval. And you think about those guys they got, the Caulfields and the Turcotts, those players are now committing to Michigan and Minnesota, not to Wisconsin. And if his one achievement is because he recruited really good guys and he's not recruiting really good guys anymore, not great. It
could be a long season for the Badgers. So Michigan plays Notre Dame, probably the team that Michigan fans like seeing least in hockey.
The last time we saw them, it went very well. So
that is true. Michigan has really struggled at Yost the last few years. The one year I think they did get a sweep, but after that, it's been a split was something you give your left arm for a while.
Well, they've been swept at Yost against Notre Dame for two straight years.
Right. So Notre Dame is starting to look a little bit better. I think they had a rocky-ish start where they dropped a game to RIT, and then they lost two to Minnesota. But this past weekend, they looked good.
Yeah, well, you look at their season, and I think they're indicative of a team that is sort of in the second tier, maybe a notch below Minnesota because they lost both those games to the Gophers. But
yeah,
they have some good results. They beat Tech in overtime, and I think Michigan Tech's a pretty solid team.
On the road.
Yes. And, you know, they cleaned up against Wisconsin, but I don't think Wisconsin is good at all. They beat Holy Cross. That's an Atlantic Hockey team. They won 6-0 and then lost in overtime to RIT. That's an Atlantic Hockey team. So we just don't know very much. You know, Minnesota and maybe Tech are the only two teams that we think were supposed to be good that they've played. And they're 1-2 against those two teams, with the one win being in overtime. So on paper, this is a team Michigan should be better than, but Notre Dame is going to be a team like Minnesota State that presents a different look for Michigan to face. And I think that's kind of notable. They've only given up 19 goals on the season, and seven of them were on Ryan Bischel in three games, which is not great.
Yeah.
But their other goalie, who I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that name. I think it's Galata, maybe.
Galata.
It's got a weird J in there. But he's been great. I mean, you saw that one coming a mile away when, yeah, like, this incredible goalie from Cornell is now coming to Notre Dame. It's just like, yeah, we've seen this one before.
Yeah.
So he's been really good for them. A 1.58 goals against, 9.36 save percentage. And, you know, his save percentage is 36 points higher than Bischel. So it's pretty clear that he is a step up from Bischel. Well,
they played him both early on, and I think now it's,
yeah, they've decided who's the guy. But overall, it's going to be a matchup of contrasts, right? Michigan plays an offensive style with all the firepower in the world, and Notre Dame is definitely going to try to lock this game down. First goal will be massive, just as it was against MSU a couple weekends ago, and it was against Minnesota State back in Duluth. So that's something to watch, because offensively they're not going to blow you away.
Well, the interesting thing when I was looking at the eight statistics I usually look up before talking about a team is, you know, they are 13th in Corsi, which is, I thought, was interesting, because usually when you're looking at Big Ten teams, you know, Michigan's opponents tend to be in and around where they're at, but Notre Dame is the one that usually isn't, them and Michigan State. And, you know, they're in the top quarter.
Well, they've definitely heaped the goals on the bad teams they've played, right? They hung six on RIT. They put up five on LIU. They put up five on Holy Cross. They put up five on Wisconsin. But against who I think are the three good teams, three games against two good teams they played, Minnesota and Tech, they have scored five total goals in those three games against those two teams. So I think there's probably a little bit of
context
and inflation going on here in terms of where they're really scoring the goals. The other thing I think is interesting about Notre Dame is they're kind of like, you know how the Blue Jays have like all legacy players whose dads were MLB guys?
Yeah.
They've got just all the brothers. They've got the Swigerts. They've got the Janikies. There's a few other guys that used to have brothers on the team, like Cam Burke and Cal Burke.
And they missed out on Pastyov.
Yeah, so they just like brothers. That's what we'll say about them.
They're eighth in pairwise. They have a 15% scoring rate on a power play, which is not great, but they're 95% on the penalty kill, which seems unsustainable.
Unstoppable force meets a movable object.
Yeah.
Weekend.
They have 9 drafted skaters, which seemed higher than I would have guessed, but their highest are due in the third
round. Yeah. Yeah. They're
so
really
it's all
good.
A bunch of
they really recruit against, the guys in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth round, which isn't a bad strategy because you get them for multiple years, but they have a little bit of talent and you can build a sustainable program off of that, right? It's ask Wisconsin, a lot less sustainable when you're only dealing with first round picks. So
that's true.
Unless you recruit 5 first rounders a year, and then it's kind of sustainable.
And then you're Michigan
at Mel Pearson.
They also have 3 guys that are scoring over 0.75 points per game, including Max Ellis, who's at 1.27. And I think he's played in like 11 or 12 games. So they do have a guy that does create some goals. And you touched on their goalie.
They also have Salag Bakic, which has always been one of the weird names in college hockey. It looks like Pivanka's gone, though, so that's a legacy guy that they don't have anymore.
And Steves is gone.
Yes, Steves is gone, and he was their best offensive player last year, but it looks like Max Ellis has stepped up in that capacity.
So Michigan is currently winning the Big Ten. They are up by, is it 4 points? No, they're up by a couple points.
You know, some teams haven't played the proper number of games because of the buys and stuff, so it's a little uneven. But by points percentage, they are up, yes.
So big weekend. You know, I said the last weekend Michigan needs to win both games. It's tough to say that against Notre Dame. Obviously, you want to say that, yeah, they're better than Notre Dame. They probably are. They should win two games, but in a tough matchup series like this, I would probably be more okay with the split this weekend than the previous two weekends.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Any last parting words for this hockey cast? Is there anything else that we went over? I think we touched on pretty much
everything. I
want
to throw out that women's soccer is still in the NCAA tournament.
That's true. Hosting, I believe.
Yeah, they're playing, I think, Wake Forest this weekend in a preview of the Peach Bowl.
Hey, you don't know what's going to happen in a week and a half.
But
Don't go the route of Brian.
Yeah, shout out to them. And yeah, it should be an interesting weekend at Yost. It's, you know, this is a big stretch. It's 4 weeks until the Christmas break. And you've got Notre Dame, you've got Minnesota, you've got Ohio State, the three teams that look like they might have a shot in the conference. Mm-hmm. You get a virtual bye in between there against Niagara on Thanksgiving weekend. But, you know, these six games will really tell a lot. And this begins that stretch. Michigan has had a tendency to go down like the Hindenburg in the final month before Christmas.
Right.
It would be fun not to do that this year. So it all starts this weekend.
They can win a few of these games and all of a sudden they're the team that everyone's chasing. Like it's normally been Minnesota and Notre Dame in the past. And it would be nice if maybe it was Michigan this year.
It'd also be nice to not have to win like 10 of your last 12 games to make the tournament. So
I don't think we have to worry too much about that with this team.
Hopefully not. Thank you for listening to Michigan HockeyCast 4.7 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. If you manage to survive 120 minutes of Notre Dame hockey with your own eyeballs watching it, and you come back next week and listen to this podcast, we will give you a prize.